Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we're in the same space recording for the first time since December of 2020.
It's been a wild ride.
Oh my, I was like, okay, so 2021's going to start a little bumpy. I had no idea.
No, well, no idea at all.
No idea.
I could not have predicted all that has occurred. And a lot of that which had occurred would have occurred anyways, no matter the year. Like my class, I had a very intensive class, mm-hmm. which was why we sort of extended the break a little bit. And
yeah.
But then...
And then it snowed twice.
Blizzard.
Blizzard.
Like
twice
blizzard.
In a week. And we didn't have power and water. And you ended up having to stay at a hotel.
Yeah, because our HVAC went out the week before, so we saw it coming.
Yeah, yes.
So we made arrangements. But nobody at that time, even if we were preparing to hunker down,
right.
nobody had a clue that the Texas power grid was going to be in catastrophic failure.
That's not entirely true. Somebody knew. Just okay, that the average person
the average
didn't know.
Civilian did not know. You're so right. There are people who know, and we're tracking them down. But yeah, so we didn't really, as people, expect to have these power problems that we
right.
ended up having. So a lot of people had burst pipes and all of that kind of stuff because we didn't know we needed to winterize because we didn't know we were going to lose power. And oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's just.
What a fiasco.
But. We did have time to watch a delightful and confusing movie called Memento, which is what we're talking about today.
Doesn't it feel like life? If you've seen Memento, like when I rewatched this, it was like, wow, I had no idea when I watched this all the way back in year 2000 that this would feel so salient to me now.
20 years later.
It's just ridiculous. I do love this movie, though.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, let's talk about it. The reverse chronology stunner that gave us Christopher Nolan as an amazing writer and filmmaker and tossed Guy Pearce into the big leagues.
Yes.
Which is amazing. So Christopher Nolan did a gritty and amazing job on a Batman trilogy. Batman Begins, Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises. He educated us a little with Dunkirk. And he's utterly confused and delighted us first with Memento, which sent him into the stratosphere. And later with Inception and Interstellar and Tenet.
I mean, I love Christopher Nolan. I only have one knock, and it's the one thing we all have trouble with is his sound. His sound design, and it's his choice. This is something he does. And he just loves to have that loud music when people are talking about, like, ridiculously difficult things to understand.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't do it in Memento because
no.
It wasn't there yet. So I was like, yeah. But this movie was so good that, you know what? When he walked out of that, every studio in Hollywood was like, take our money.
Uh-huh.
Do whatever the heck you want to.
Yeah, and this is after the studios... refused to pick up the movie.
Yeah.
Like it was like huge at the film festivals.
Yeah.
Everybody loved it. Standing mm-hmm. ovations. And they were like, it's fantastic. We won't buy it.
Yeah, they wouldn't buy it.
Until it made, you know, like mm-hmm. On a $5 million budget, it made $25 million domestically and another $15 million internationally. So, you know, that's a pretty good return. And then they finally... got their attention.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But in the meantime, he was able to make anything he wanted after that.
So yes.
Obviously, we are biased. We just love this movie. So we're just going to be raving, just raving uh-huh. about it.
Yeah.
I'm super excited to find out what you found out because I can't wait to learn more about this.
Okay. Well,
so dive in.
Lots of good stuff. All right. So Guy Pearce is Leonard. He mm-hmm. probably his other biggest thing has been The Hurt Locker.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Academy Award winning mm-hmm. film. Carrie Ann Moss is Natalie. And of course, she's most famous for the Matrix movies. Joe Pantoliano plays Teddy / John G. Also in the Matrix and dozens of supporting roles in TV and film. Very, very specific sorts of parts, but in lots of different shows. He's got a lot of range, but he's very much a character actor.
Yes, he is.
Playing a small range of things.
Right.
But he's great. Mark Boone Jr. is Bert. He was also in Batman Begins, and he was Bobby Elvis in Sons of Anarchy.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay.
So I was like, what has that guy been in? Oh, Sons of Anarchy.
Lots of familiar faces throughout whole film. But yeah, you're right. And he's pretty, he's fun. Something about him is just delightful. Like, stay on screen. More.
Yeah. He's like a teddy bear. You want to give him a hug.
Yeah.
Even though he's very threatening looking.
It's so true.
Georgia Fox plays Leonard's wife, and she has like nary a line hardly in this movie at all. But for 3 years before this, she was in ER, and for 15 years after this, she was in CSI.
Mm-hmm. It really speaks to the, I credit Christopher Nolan, but it speaks to the importance of casting these, quote, smaller roles. That just because it's a short or small part doesn't lessen the importance that it gets done really well and with excellence. Because all of these little parts, these scenes that you see with these characters, I mean, that could have broken the whole thing.
Right.
They needed to be good.
Right. And you needed somebody who could act without speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a talent.
Yeah.
A lot of people cannot do this.
Right.
And then Stephen Tobolowsky is Sammy Jenkins. He was in Spaceballs, Single White Female, Groundhog Day, lots and lots of stuff.
Lots of stuff.
Very familiar face. Yeah.
Yep. And then there's one more we have to mention.
Okay.
Because if you're a Frasier fan, you're going to be interested to know that Harriet Sanson Harris is Mrs. Jenkins.
Okay. Yeah.
And she plays Frasier's agent. On Frasier.
Oh, I had made that connection.
And talk about two totally different characters that she plays there. It's kind of interesting to see her younger and doing that role.
Yeah, doing this very Frasier. Different kind of role. Yep.
She's a hoot.
All right. So recap.
Okay. Good luck. Godspeed.
Okay. I'm going to take the word recap and use it very loosely here.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. So we immediately understand how this whole movie works because there's a Polaroid reverse developing over the opening credits, and it's subtle and fantastic.
Yes, it is.
I mean, just really, it's so good. So there's a whole series of scenes that are either in color or black and white. And I think it's really important to understand that the color scenes are going backwards in time. The scenes themselves are running forward, but their order is backwards.
Right.
And then the black and white scenes are in chronological order.
Right.
And they kind of meet up at the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
See, he's been working on Tenet for so long.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's spoiler alert. Woo! Erase that. Go on.
Okay. It is wildly confusing, though.
It can be wildly. You have to like sit there and let it do.
Yes, exactly. You gotta just take it at face value.
Yes.
And try and understand. So Leonard knows who he is and that he has a mission to avenge the rape and murder of his wife. And this same man gave Leonard a rare neurological condition where he can no longer make new memories. And this makes his singular mission that much more challenging. It's a game of cat and mouse, and Leonard can really never be sure whether he's the cat or the mouse. Is Teddy helping Leonard, or is he lying to him? Is he a cop, or is he a robber? Is Natalie a bartender and erstwhile girlfriend to a drug dealer? Is she sympathetic or conniving? What does Leonard even know for sure about his own past? So here's the real summary of this movie. Who is this bastard and why is he lying to me?
Yes. Yes.
That is the summary of this movie.
That is the summary of the year right there. Yes. That's it.
That's right.
That's it.
Cheers to my college professor, Dean Rader. Thank you so much. So Roger Ebert points out a plot hole that I did not recognize.
Okay.
And he didn't recognize it either until a man named Vasundhara Gandhi of Queens Village, New York,
okay,
wrote to Roger Ebert and said, "I love the film, but I don't understand one key plot point. If the last thing the main character remembers is his wife dying, then how does he remember he has short-term memory loss?" Well, how would he know?
Right. Like, maybe he should act more like a goldfish. Yeah, like, I mean, surprised by everything all the time. Right.
Well, and so Roger Ebert says he thinks about it as Tom Hanks' character in Joe versus the Volcano, who had a brain fog. And he said, "Leonard suffers from a condition brought on by a screenplay that finds it necessary. And it's unkind of us to inquire too deeply."
Basically, suspend your belief.
Suspend your disbelief about this and enjoy the movie for what it is. Because
how does he know he has short-term memory loss?
If the last thing he remembers is his wife dying. We're just going to ignore the plot hole because it's a plot hole. I mean, you can drive a truck through.
I don't know. I feel like, yeah, that's true. But also, if he wakes up somewhere different and knows that the last thing he remembers is something else, and then there's all his notes saying what he has, he's actually reminding himself every day.
That would have to be the first thing he reminded himself of every time he woke up, and that's not what's happening.
Well, yeah, we don't see that happening.
But we don't know how long he's been doing this either.
Right, we have no idea.
Right.
We have no idea. Yeah, it kind of, you would think it would be more like 50 First Dates.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Where she has to watch the video every morning to figure out what's happening.
Gosh, and I love that movie,
too. I did, too. I love that movie.
I didn't think about it as being a funny companion to Memento.
It really kind of is. It's the same thing, except
they don't leave this plot hole there.
Yeah, they don't leave it there. That's the whole point of it, is that she can't remember. Every day she wakes up, it's the same day.
Right.
So Leonard should wake up screaming
every
day looking for his wife, and then have something remind him of everything. But
right.
You know, but he does address one thing. He says, it's not about memory, it's about routine. And he had built it into an habitual place.
Right.
Basal ganglia. He had gone bypassed memory into habit.
Okay.
Which could account for why he's able to function in this.
Okay.
Because by habit. But no, it's a pretty big plot hole.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty big.
You have to work really hard.
Yeah, to try and, Roger Ebert thought it was maybe a little too clever for its own good. Yeah. So he watched it the first time and said he thought he'd understand it better watching it a second time. Mm-hmm. And watching it the second time, he said, yes, I understood the plot better, but really, confusion is the state we are intended to be in.
Yeah.
So you don't really, understanding the plot is less important than feeling the feelings of empathy for the main character, basically.
Right.
Okay. So here's a commentary on quarantine.
Okay.
I have more articles about the movie, about people trying to figure it all out. They're all from 2020.
Makes me so happy. I don't know why, because what did I just say? It's so salient. What is it about this movie that is so salient now? When I watched it in 2000, now I have to tell you the funniest story, a little aside. When we watched this movie, we rented it, you know, on DVD, right? Mm-hmm. And we brought it home and we didn't know. We were watching this movie and it was like, what's happening? Well, there was a scratch on the DVD. So not only is this movie going backwards and forwards in time all at the same time, but the movie keeps reverting to the original track. So it would, or to this one track. Uh-huh. So it would go past it, and then it'd always go back to Liddy. And so we saw that scene like 18 times, and we're like, no, this has got to be wrong. So finally, I'm looking at the little LCD display, and I see the tracks going, and I see the track go back. And I was like, that's what's wrong. So you want to talk about state of confusion? That was hard.
You just didn't have a chance from the very beginning. We didn't have a chance.
Yeah. But.
All right. So Matt Goldberg on Collider said that Memento remains Christopher Nolan's best movie about self-deception. Ooh. Which I'm like, oh, he does have a lot of movies about self-deception, doesn't he? because you're never quite exactly sure what's real and what's fictional.
Right.
This, and especially like in Inception.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You don't really know what's real. That's why the whole little spinny top thing.
Then he screws us over right at the end by not even showing us.
But I love, that's what I love. You screws us over. I'm like, it's perfect.
Well, I do like it. Still screws us over, but I still kind of like it. Yeah.
So what Matt Goldberg has to say about it is the reverse chronology really puts us in the mindset of a brain damage detective. We can empathize with him so much because it's going backwards and we're a little confused perpetually throughout this movie.
Questioning what you know.
Yes. And that Leonard clings to what control he thinks he has.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, he doesn't really have any control. It's an illusion.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah.
It's an illusion, but he's doing the best he can.
Right. Right.
But
theoretically, he should be able to solve this case.
Theoretically.
With the notes that he has and the processes he's set up for himself, that he should be able to do that. But we eventually learn that he's not really working towards vengeance or justice or any of that. He's clinging to scraps of his identity.
Yeah.
He's
but what else would he do?
Well, exactly. What else could he do?
What else could he do?
He doesn't really know who he is. And that memento recognizes that we all lie to ourselves,
mm-hmm.
which I'm like, well, that's true. We it like to true. Pretend we don't lie to ourselves, but the fact that we pretend that we don't lie to ourselves is self a lie.
Yeah.
Hello.
But there's always a little sign.
Yeah. Well,
okay. So for instance, right in the film, when he writes down the license plate, when he's out at the place where he had already killed people before.
Right.
And he writes down the license plate and he writes down the I. Now he writes down the I and the L in the same way. Right? Yeah, did you catch this?
Yes, but he knows
which one is which when he gets to the tattoo shop. How does he know which one is which? If he wrote it down the same, and that's all he has, how would he know that this one over here that he wrote was a little I and that is an L? Except that he does remember seeing the license plate and he knows how he wrote it down. Just like we all do when we do stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
We all do it.
Yeah.
We all write it down in our own little shorthand and we know what's an L and what's an I and what's a whatever.
Uh-huh.
Right? But he gets this license plate and then he gets it tattooed the correct way. So that actually may be the plot hole filler.
Okay.
He doesn't have short-term memory loss.
Yeah. He does, but he doesn't.
He's delusional. It could be a complete delusion.
Huh.
Or it could be a mixture.
Right.
Maybe he has a hard time converting memories,
mm-hmm.
but it's not as bad. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
It's like, that's like a really important detail.
Right.
Credit to my husband. He's absolutely the one who was like, oh, that's an eye on his thigh. And I was like, well, I don't want to share. What do you
want? Yeah.
Why are we obsessed with the eye on his thigh? Because when he wrote it on the paper, it was a big eye and now it's a little eye. Big, that's a big thing.
Uh-huh.
Little thing.
It's a little thing that's a big thing.
Yeah.
It's a little thing if you don't notice that it's a big thing when you do.
Yeah.
Ooh, uh-huh. Ooh, isn't that an interesting commentary on this whole movie?
Yeah.
It's the little things that you don't notice don't matter unless you notice them and then they really matter.
Yeah. Which is very much like life.
Oh, you just look so defeated when you said that.
I just feel like, Christopher Nolan, why? I don't know. Maybe I feel like he's making things happen. Like, he's the one that's actually, like, he's Jumanji right now. Like,
uh-huh.
Finish the game, man. Put it all back together. What are you writing right now? Abandoned script. Stop. Go put it away.
Yeah, because the murder hornets disappeared.
Yeah, he must have just changed his plot.
Why can't we forget the murder hornets then?
I don't know.
I mean, for Pete's sake.
Murder hornets. That's pretty amazing.
That was like a year ago. We were all worried about the murder hornets.
I know. But the bees, they stuffed up. Did you ever see this? How bees kill a murder hornet?
No.
OMG, you got to look this up. There is some video about this. Okay, so bees can, they use their numbers and bees can like vibrate.
Oh.
Okay, so the murder hornet gets into, they trap it. They know it's after him and they trap it and they bring it in and the bees all vibrate around it so fast it heats up the core between them and the core temperature that the bees can handle is higher than the core temperature that the murder hornet can handle and they burn him alive. As a group, they get together, they vibrate and heat themselves up so much that the murder hornet like dies in the middle of it from heat stroke. And because the bees can withstand it and then they disappear. The bees to the rescue.
Bees are the bug we don't deserve.
I mean, seriously.
Okay, so I'm going to find that video because I'm intensely interested.
Yeah,
I'm gonna
Discovery put it on Channel our... has some out there. Yeah. Like Nat Geo had some things. So there's some like pretty legit
I will find one and I'll put it on our social media. Yeah, so you can find us on Facebook, Killer Fun Podcast, Exploring the Intersection of Crime and Entertainment, on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod, or you can send us an email, killerfunpodcast@gmail.com. Oh my gosh. So the last thing I want to say about this article, this was really insightful. I think an insight you can only get from 2020. Christopher Nolan made a movie where the lie itself becomes the protagonist.
Oh, nice. Yes.
Is that 2020 in a nutshell?
I mean, in a nutshell, we're still there.
I know, it's just 2020 part deux.
Yeah.
Except it's not nearly as funny as whatever the movie was that had the part deux.
Oh, wait, what was that?
What was
part
that?
Duh. I don't remember, but I remember.
I can see all the people, Steve Martin, hot shots.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Part deux.
That was funny.
It was fun. Those I saw it in the movie fun. Theater and it was so raunchy
just
and
good
funny.
Fun.
Oh. Memento is loosely based on a short story called Memento Mori that was written by Christopher Nolan's brother, Jonathan Nolan.
Right, who's a fantastic writer.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it was published in Esquire, I think. I'll have a link to that too. But it wasn't Jonathan Nolan, it was Nathan Nolan.
Oh.
And I'm like... It until like 2 days ago, it never occurred to me that Nathan was a nickname for Jonathan.
Oh, is it? Like,
yes.
Like commonly?
Like you take out, that's where
Nathan.
That's where it came from. It's a, whoa. It's a shortened version of Jonathan. Never occurred to me at all. Yeah. I was like, why does it say Jonathan Nolan and Nathan Nolan? You'd think he'd put the right name on his Esquire magazine short story.
Or if it was an alias, he would go a little further.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But that makes sense. How about that?
Mind blown. Yeah.
See, the Nolan brothers, they do a lot of good work together.
Yes.
They really do.
Yes. And it's super interesting because they kind of wrote these concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan pitched the idea to Christopher, and they kind of concurrently wrote the script and the short story, shared with one another, and incorporated some things, but a lot of things are different. So Screen Rant had an article about 10 differences. I'm going to go over
between the story and the film.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
Let's hear
I'm
it.
Gonna,
let's hear
just
it.
A few of them.
Okay.
So the lead actor, the lead character is Leonard in the movie, but his name is Earl in the short story.
Okay.
Which I was like, that's an interesting choice.
Yeah, I'm glad. Well, I'm glad Leonard.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I, like
I don't care. Lenny. It's fine. I'm with Leonard on that. No, Lenny. No. It sounds like he's going to squeeze a mouse.
Yeah, that's true.
So in the short story, Earl is a mental patient in a institution, and all the plans he is making are what you see in the story.
See, the delusional thing.
Yeah. The story was set in Montreal. The movie is set in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. The ending's kind of ambiguous. Even more ambiguous in the story because Earl is in this mental institution and escapes. And you don't know what happens after he escapes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, whereas we don't know what happens to Lenny. We do and we don't. I mean, we don't know what happens after the first scene.
We just know that we sort of just...
I mean...
We don't know what happens next because it closes the story.
Right.
We know the ending because of the beginning.
Right. We know that we know the end from the beginning, but we don't know what happens after that.
Right.
So there's a similar ambiguity, but in a different
because
order.
Because we don't know what happens. Yeah. No, that makes sense. It is still very similar.
Yeah. In the short story, there's no Teddy and no Natalie. Earl is talking to himself primarily. Leonard remembers enough that he has amnesia, but Earl is never really quite sure what happened. So he does a lot of speculation.
Okay.
He has to speculate a lot more because there's less of that plot hole.
In the short story.
And Leonard is very interested in healing. How can I heal if I can't feel time?
That's right.
He's interested in some kind of closure, whereas Earl has really given up on healing and he doesn't really seem to even want to move on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are some of the comments, the dialogue from Leonard in the movie that really hit hard. Like, how can I heal when I can't feel time? Uh-huh. I think everybody in 2020 going into now, time is no longer what we, it doesn't cadence the same way it did before. It doesn't feel the same way it did before. Like, I'm a month behind because of 1 week last week.
Right.
Right? Like, I'm having to play catch up. And it's weird because time just feels so different. And you already feel it differently as you get older and all of these things. And so... You're right. How do you heal when you can't feel the time?
Well, and what did he say? I can't remember to forget you.
Yeah.
I'm like,
those are really poignant.
Really like speak to a larger sort of.
Which is what they do. Yeah. Nolan people.
Well, yes. Mm-hmm.
They do a good job with that.
And then the last one before we go to our break, Mike Floorwalker had an article for Looper and. Man, people have been just trying to unpack this movie for years. I think the problem is people really want a simple, straightforward, easy to understand explanation of this movie, and there just isn't one.
Right. They want a Signs moment. They want an M. Night Shyamalan kind of moment.
Yeah.
And there's this
Swing Away.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Like, exactly.
They want to understand that, and there just isn't, because this is a little... more like life.
Yeah.
Whether that's good or bad, if you're seeking escapism, maybe this isn't the movie for you.
That's true. No, watch 50 First Dates instead.
Yes. Same flavor, but funny and heartwarming. Teddy suggests to Leonard that the whole Sammy Jenkins thing is a lie.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, there's debate as to that, but... You know, the idea is that Leonard accidentally killed his own wife after the accident and then invented Sammy Jenkins to protect himself. But I'm like, wouldn't that mean he has to have some sort of memory, which maybe he does. But if he can assign that to somebody else, he have to remember that it happened
to them.
Right.
Unless it really happened and he's pulling on long-term memory.
Right.
Because a delusion, you'd have to remember the delusion kind of. So that does call up a lot of questions about like, how does that get stored?
Right.
Yeah.
But he just observes how Teddy's story could be totally true, totally false, a mixed bag that... Leonard really does lie to himself. Mm-hmm. Do I lie to myself to be happy? In your case, Teddy, yes, I will. And really, you know, that's what it comes down to. And that's why that moment is at the end of the movie and not at the beginning or the middle of the movie.
Right.
Because isn't it interesting that that's the climax? It's not a murder. It's a decision.
Yeah.
Which is so interesting.
Yeah, like he make and that's crazy because keep on killing. Like, Teddy's already used him.
Right.
Like, this is where the crimey part comes in, right?
Right.
Is that Teddy is using him. So not only is there a crime in the beginning, and then Leonard is supposedly tracking down the person, but also now Teddy is using him because Teddy's an undercover cop and has now decided, as far as we understand, if we believe Teddy's rant at the end, right, he's the one telling Leonard, listen, sure, you're a freak. I used you, but yeah. I used you and I'm cleaning up the streets. And what do you care? You're not going to remember anyway. Right? And that's where Leonard gets snarky and turns it around on him and says...
justifiably angry.
Yeah, justifiably angry. Because if that's true, ugh, what an awful manipulation. Now Teddy's turned him into a murderer.
Well, and you wonder how many times he's been manipulated this way, how many different people have manipulated him, because Teddy manipulates Leonard. Yep. And then Natalie manipulates Leonard in really horribly... Horribly. Awful. It's just the way they use him is awful.
Yeah.
It's just, it's really, it's, again, you're looking for a lighthearted, lighthearted movie. Maybe this isn't the one for you right now, but it's so good.
But it is so good.
It's so good.
And there's a lot of comedic moments.
Right.
I mean, the comedy is really good. Kai Pierce is... he's on point, man. Some of that, some scenes, I just laugh and have to rewind it and watch him do it again because it's just too funny.
Well, and he's so deadpan.
I mean,
he does such a good job of just like delivering those lines with no affect whatsoever.
Yeah. Like, I can just see the scenes. They're just so funny. Uh-huh. All right.
Yeah.
Whew.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with Is It True? Psychology Break and Real Life.
Hi, I'm Steph.
And I'm John, and we're the hosts of the Get Lit podcast.
Each week, we profile a different famous author, from their strange writing habits to their mysterious deaths.
For example, did you know that Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's wife died by accidentally setting herself on fire while sealing letters?
Or that J.D. Salinger was an entertainment director on a cruise ship before writing Catcher in the Rye?
So, if you want the backstories of the most iconic works of literature and the people who wrote them, check out the Get Lit podcast.
Available wherever you like to listen. And thank you, as always, for keeping it lit.
Welcome back. Thanks for sticking with us through that little break. We're going to go into our sections now. And if you are new to the show, I'm going to remind you that what's happening here is that Christy is screwing up her search history just for the NSA's fun. Just so that she can find really fun things. And then she is going to tell me what she found. And then I'm going to, you know, react to it. So basically she's trying to like shock me, blow my mind or whatever. So yeah. It's always fun to see. So I can't wait to see what you found. So let's go ahead and start with, is it true?
That's right. All right. So, is John G. real? I mean, no, but well, yes, no. A little bit, because so Jonathan became a screenwriter and he studied at Georgetown University, and John G. was an ode to his screenwriting professor. John Glavin.
Oh my gosh, so it was kind of based on a true thing.
So a little bit.
That's so funny.
All right.
I wonder how he feels about that.
Should you shake a Polaroid?
Okay, no, right? The answer is no.
The answer is no, but yes. Everybody shakes the Polaroid. I'm sorry,
Outcast.
Yeah.
Shake it like a Polaroid picture. You're not supposed to do that.
You're not, but for Pete's sake, I mean, that song is so great. Okay, there actually is a reason why we do that.
Why?
So if you shake a Polaroid, it will either do nothing or have a potential to damage it.
Right.
Because the film that's developing is sandwiched in between the two layers of plastic.
Right.
So you're not drying it. But it actually came from a peel-apart version, an earlier version of Polaroid film, where you had to peel two pieces apart. And my parents had one of these.
Okay.
But I never saw it. They would tell me about it.
Okay.
But they didn't have it anymore because you couldn't buy film for it anymore. So you'd take it and you'd have to peel it apart and then you could shake it. And
To
dry it. But when they advanced the technology, people were still used to shaking the picture.
So they just kept doing it. This is so funny.
Yeah.
I remember my mind being completely blown when I realized you should not do that.
No.
Like, not only does it not help, but like, don't, because it's not good for it.
Right. I mean, you can literally ruin it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Though I've never ruined a Polaroid by shaking it.
Me either. So.
Yeah. Antero grade amnesia?
Yeah. Real. 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 It is a real thing.
Yeah. It is indeed the inability to create new memories, but retaining your long-term memories.
Right.
So retrograde amnesia would be where you wake up and don't know who you are.
Right.
And you don't remember anything from before the injury.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because we watched this movie with our kids and they had a question and I kind of answered it for them, but they were like, well, but then how is he able to stay in these longer conversations? And some conversations are really short and he forgets. And if you notice throughout the film, there's always some sort of break. A door slam, something hits.
Okay.
And so we kind of talked about the difference between working memory and short-term memory. Because you have working memory, which is the, it's right now, like what we're doing. Mm-hmm. But like it would be, for him, it was when that closes, when that conversation closes, when the situation closes, that's when it can't convert. To the short term. So that's why he's able to have all these conversations that are longer, right?
It's when he gets distracted from that.
Which is why when Natalie leaves, he's like, find a pen, because he knows as soon as she's gone, the working he's going to have to move on from the situation.
Right.
And that's why when she walks in, she slams the door. Bam.
Yeah.
Now he's out of it.
Yeah.
He
can't remember.
He can't remember. So that was really interesting.
Yeah. It's got a lot of causes. It could be drug use. Mm-hmm. Prescription drugs can cause it. Traumatic brain injury, brain inflammation, surgery, stroke, short-term alcohol blackout, mm-hmm. long-term chronic alcoholism. We'll talk more about that later. Concussions, some of them are temporary, some of them are permanent.
Right.
Usually if it's like a traumatic brain injury or surgery or something chronic or a stroke, that's going to be long-term.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's from a concussion, you usually will recover that sort of stuff. Most of the causes of short-term memory loss are permanent.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Sad.
How accurate was the portrayal in this movie? According to experts, actually really accurate.
Oh, good.
Yeah. That it's one of the most realistic and accurate depictions of anterograde amnesia in entertainment.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that because it felt so authentic.
Yeah.
Right? And I've never met anybody with this. This is something you read about. You read about it in textbooks or you read about, you know, but I've actually never met anybody with that.
And I mean, would you? I mean, really?
I mean, I don't know.
I mean, that's the
thing. And would you know if you did?
I mean, you probably would know if you did, if you met them more than once or more than in passing.
Right.
But I'd say a lot of these people don't. It's rare, first of all. Really rare. But it's also, where do these people live?
Yeah.
I mean, really, they need care.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they're not safe to live on their own, usually.
Right. Because, that makes
There's a reason sense. Why he would have been in an escaped mental institution.
Yeah.
Resident.
Because he would need to be inpatient to function.
Right.
People would have to help him.
Yes, exactly.
Or he needs a video
Every morning. Yeah.
Like, we keep going back to 51st days. I'm glad to hear that it was pretty accurate because I feel like that's a really weird condition to have to portray.
Right.
You know? And what's really interesting about it was just because he had this condition where he couldn't convert memory, he still had insight. He still had thoughts, meta kind of thoughts. And that was a very interesting thing. And I think that's what we don't realize is that really you don't turn into a goldfish with no thoughts and feelings and dreams and hopes. And
yeah, you're just a lot more confused by everything you do think and feel. And
yeah.
Yep. So can I stay at the Discount Inn?
Please tell me this exists.
I should have waited until you were done with your drinking your coffee to ask that. Well, yes and no. Because the Discount Inn isn't real, but it was really filmed at the Travel Inn.
Oh, okay, good. So it was on location somewhere then.
Yeah, it was in Los Angeles. And can you get a drink at Ferdy's Bar? Again, yes or no? Yes and no.
Okay, but it was a real location?
It was a real location called the Blue Room Bar in Burbank, California.
Cool.
Yeah. So you can go and get a drink there. Hopefully no one will spit in your beer.
Oh. That scene is so funny. Oh, bless his heart. Okay.
So Natalie is really unsure of Leonard's condition. She tests him, and then she suggests that he's just a drunk. Can alcoholism affect your memory this way? According to VertanaHealth.com, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it can.
That's not good.
No. Well, you've got your short term, which is where you have a blackout, where you can either remember nothing from a specific period of time, or you only remember a little bit from
like flashes.
Right. Flashes. You get flashes, and that's it's messing with your short term memory, basically. But long term effects. So chronic alcoholism can cause long term memory loss and permanent brain damage, similar to what Leonard's going through.
Wow.
But we have no reason to, he's too, I think, too young of a man.
Probably, yeah.
To have, for that to be the issue. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the lie in who is this bastard and why is he lying to
me? Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah.
I'd agree. Yeah. Yeah.
And Natalie also very cruelly suggests to Leonard that his wife was unfaithful and that his condition is an effect of an STI, a sexually transmitted infection, though she calls it VD because evidently in
venereal
2000
disease.
We still called it VD in 2000, which seems like a totally outdated term.
I know, but that Friends episode where Joey goes to and he ends up a model for VD.
Uh-huh.
Hilarious.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, that's funny.
It was
VD. Oh, I know. God. That's an antiquated term.
Uh-huh. It is the only STI that I could find that would possibly cause such a condition was syphilis, and it would have to go untreated
for a long time.
For like a really long time. I mean, it can have no symptoms. You can have no symptoms of syphilis for, you know,
many
6 years. Months to 30 plus years. Mm-hmm. So, I mean,
and it's often misdiagnosed, especially in women.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because the overlapping symptoms.
Oh, okay.
And there was a time where so many women went undiagnosed with syphilis because they just thought they were hysterical, right?
Yeah.
The hysterics or whatever. And they did not understand that it was a legit infection.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so sad.
It is sad. All right. Psychology break.
Okay.
All right. So our memory, we've talked about this before. Very unreliable.
Very unreliable people.
Unfortunately. And this is an issue because that's a lot of what our whole justice system is built upon.
Mm-hmm.
Is people remembering events and testifying to what they remember.
Yep. Not to mention like relationships.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. But you remember things differently.
You remember things differently or not at all. And so it's so hard because you communicate and it's like you lay bricks, but when you come back, they're all in a different order. So, okay, where does the wall go now? Right.
Yeah.
Or you know what I'm saying? So how do you build and how do you, it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is why communication is really, really important. So even people with highly superior autobiographical memories, people, super memories, basically, are susceptible to a lot of errors, actually. Erica Hayasaki had an article in The Atlantic, How Many of Your Memories Are Fake? And it's a whole article about Frank Healy, who was one of these highly superior autobiographical memory people. They were studying him and, you know, he could tell you, you could give him a date and he can tell you what he had for breakfast or lunch or dinner on that day and what he was wearing and what the weather was like. And I mean, just
wow.
Yeah. There's a character in Superstore who can do that. She's an endingly boring.
Yeah.
But in such a funny way.
Funny.
Yeah. But even he is subject to unreliable memories.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked him about a particular day where he'd gone to the University of California at Irvine, where they were doing some I don't want to say studies on him. They were observing him, mm-hmm. asking him questions to understand his condition better. And how might that help us understand the average person's memory a little bit better? And so he remembered things that happened really clearly, that he went in and they immediately asked him to write down a series of letters and numbers. And he wrote it on a chalkboard with chalk. And he said he didn't really do that great on it, but he remembered there were numbers, like they gave him numbers and asked him to turn, or letters and numbers, and asked him to turn around and write it on the board.
Okay.
And he didn't do great with it.
Okay.
Which is maybe a little weird, but okay. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's not the part of his memory that worked well. He said they asked him to do this immediately, actually, according to the notes that this person had and their, they had an audio tape mm-hmm. of this whole interview. It was like 46 minutes in before they asked him to do this.
Wow.
He didn't write on a chalkboard. A green chalkboard with chalk. He wrote on a whiteboard with markers.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, even somebody who has this spectacular memory in a lot of ways can make mistakes. And so it's just interesting. Don't fault yourself too much if you can't remember exactly. But that people with this type of memory, this really highly perfected memory, mm-hmm. even though it's not perfect, have a lot more white matter in their brain.
Right.
So it's right. linking their different parts of their brain so they can recall things that most people cannot recall much more easily. But true stories, so whether that's somebody writing about it or somebody verbally giving their account or somebody interviewing somebody else and then retelling the story, it's always filtered through the teller, whomever that is that is talking about it. They have their own filter, and that our brains don't just record and retrieve information, but we make inferences, we fill gaps, we construct things.
Yep. And we encode what we encode. Mm-hmm. Some, like the gaps, those are really important because sometimes you didn't forget, you just never encoded it to begin with.
Yeah.
Like you just didn't pay attention to that detail at all. And so it wasn't encoded. And so then you try to fill in a gap because you feel like you should know, but you don't.
Right.
So your brain fills it in for you so that it's a complete story. Right. But you actually don't know that detail. It was never encoded to begin with.
And that's what's so frustrating yes. about being married is. Uh-huh. And in all relationships.
But that's the selective encoding. Like if you're at home, you're listening and you're going, I think my partner has short-term memory loss. Well, it may not be memory loss. They just might not be ever paying enough attention to encode it in the first place.
Uh-huh. Hmm. Or, but I mean, maybe they just don't encode things the same way that you do.
Right.
And that can be frustrating.
It can be frustrating. Because, you know, we reorganize the way that our memories are in our brains. Like when we sleep, they reorganize. And they reorganize over time.
Yeah.
So, for instance, there's a really interesting review of some studies. And they're proposing some interesting stuff. But they're basically saying that with fear, when we have like something that we're afraid of and we kind of learn that to be afraid of that, the way that our brains activate that memory, like right after you kind of learn this and like long time afterwards, is different. Different pathways. Oh. And in fact, what happens is they've shown through looking at different studies that it actually starts to include this one other portion of the brain that then would pull in other things. So it's like you have this information and now it's categorized in a way that it now connects to other things.
Oh, right? So you could have a phobia of one thing and then your brain pulls in other stuff and says, hey, be afraid of that too.
Well, that's true too. But this is more of, it goes into the emotional side.
Okay.
So I've learned that when it's raining outside, I can expect more spiders inside. I'm afraid of spiders. So now it's raining. Now I'm a little on edge with the spiders.
Okay.
Okay. So if I learn that to be true, which is not totally true, but it can be true.
Right.
If you're in South Georgia, it's definitely true. All right. But that could be true. Let's pretend it totally is. And that now I've learned that rain equals more spiders. Okay, how my brain recalls that then versus like down the road is different because now my brain is including an emotional and a behavioral response.
Oh.
Hopefully, what the authors of this review were proposing is that now your brain is trying to get better at the response. Instead of going, I know this, now what do I do? Instead of making it a step-by-step process, it's now coded so that when the memory is retrieved, all of the behavior and the emotion and all of the stuff that helps you deal with it is retrieved all at once.
It's raining. Be afraid of spiders.
Yeah. But that's already conditioned. Be afraid of spiders. Run away. Spray peppermint. Whatever that behavior is that you have to respond to it, it's trying to re-encode it so that all that happens at once. Right?
Oh, it's raining. I got to go get my peppermint.
There you go. So we skip the, it's raining, I'm afraid of spiders. Okay. It's raining, I go get peppermint. Yeah. Right? So now it's faster. It's a more salient response. That's their proposal. It may be for totally different reasons.
Right.
There's 100 different reasons why this emotional sector could be involved. So that's their idea. But we do know that the retrieval activation areas are different over time. And that's weird. Yeah. Our brains are very, very, very strange.
That's because they defrag while we're sleeping, basically. They do. It's like when your computer reorganizes all the information to free up some space. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's things I don't really need to know. Oh, let's put these things that I use closer together on the hard drive.
Or let's tell our brains that these tabs need to open when I wake up. Now we're going to have all these things open or shut that mess down. Right? Our brains reorganize for that. It is really interesting how that works.
So the last thing I have in this section is Leonard used tattoos to help himself make sense of different pieces of information. But obviously most people are not getting tattoos because they don't remember things.
Right.
They get tattoos for other reasons. So what are some of those reasons?
All right. Tell me one of these reasons because I have one. I wonder if this is the same.
Okay. So their culture. If they're tribal or indigenous of some kind, the example used in this article by Dan Hunter on authoritytattoo.com was the Maori indigenous people who are in New Zealand.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Subcultures.
Right.
Like biker gangs, prison gangs, political fringe group, even vegans. They might get a tattoo that identifies them officially or unofficially as part of a group.
Okay.
Yeah.
The teenagers on spring break qualify as a subgroup.
I mean,
that's not where my tattoo is from, but boy, I came close.
It might be something personal or meaningful to that person that they have. It's just something significant that reminds them of a particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just that they like the look of a tattoo. They might want to express themselves as individuals. Mm-hmm. They might be rebelling against family.
Oh, yeah. Yep. That happens.
Another one is that they have imperfections.
And they're covering.
Covering. So they have scarring or issues of some kind, you know, varicose veins or cellulite or whatever, and they want to cover that up. It's, you know, they find that to be more pleasing.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can use the way the skin is to accentuate those tattoos. Mm-hmm. So if it's to cover a scar, they might incorporate the way the skin is pulled in that scar to accentuate the tattoo and make it more interesting. And then there's the people who are addicted to the pain and the process of it.
Okay.
You know, some people just, they have an affinity for once they get their first one and it's, you know, just uncomfortable situation, but they find exhilaration and.
Yeah. It's adventurous.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I guess.
What was the one you were thinking of?
Probably like the significance.
Yeah.
Yeah. The significance category.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. All right, real life.
Real life. Okay, I can't even imagine what you got.
Eek. All right, so the color palette in the film.
Ooh, yes.
Was color in film, particularly in noir films, which this is
a noir
film, is really helpful towards telling the story. So there was black and white and kind of a yellow color palette for the color versions of it. So the yellow will invoke feelings of dishonesty, betrayal, deceit, illness, hazard. Those are some of the things that a more muted yellow color palette. Now, a brighter yellow color palette might be more like relaxation and joy and happiness. But this is a kind of muted yellow. And so it does these other things.
Interesting.
And then the black in black and white can relay mystery, fear, anonymity, unhappiness. Those were all things that he was kind of dealing with.
Yeah, that's true.
What are some other films
that do this?
Right. There are plenty of them. The Guardian has 5 of them for us. The Wizard of Oz is probably the best known one, where it starts out in this sepia kind of black and white.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then when Dorothy gets to Oz, it's not just color, it's technicolor.
Right.
It's very, like, saturated, and it gives you a different kind of understanding and feeling.
Right, right.
Yeah. There's a movie called A Matter of Life and Death, where heaven and earth are depicted differently. So black and white is for heaven, and then there's this kind of rosy hue to the color portions that are on earth.
Okay.
Yeah. Schindler's List.
Yeah. I remember.
With the little girl in her red coat. And that's interesting because it's more of a spot color.
Right. Yeah. It's not a full on.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, so a lot of those are scenes. They're either black and white or color, except for Schindler's List, really. But Pleasantville used it.
This is what I thought of immediately.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where, you know, people change, they become
colorful. Once they learn something.
Yeah. Once they have an epiphany of some sort. And it was so effective and interesting. And that's a great
movie. It was like kind of surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not only did Leonard have a lot of tattoos, which we've mentioned, he also gave himself stick and poke tattoos.
Yeah.
And these are increasingly common.
Oh, really? Increasingly? Oh, see, now that's mind-blowing. I would not have thought it was increasingly common.
Oh, increasingly common, partly because it's, like, fashionable. It's becoming more fashionable to do these poke and stick tattoos.
Okay, I wonder if Amazon like sells a kit for this.
Well, I don't know if Amazon does, but in this article in the Independent, there was a woman who was putting together kits that had professional ink and sterilized tattoo or sterilized needles and gloves.
$40 or $25, all good reviews. Actually, the $25 one, hand poke and stick tattoo kit, it has like over 1,000 reviews, and it's like a 4.5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah, 4.5 stars.
Wow.
For $25, and it's Prime.
Are you thinking you want a poke and stick tattoo?
No, but it's just amazing that exists.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it used to be like the kind of thing you only saw from like
prisons. Yeah.
Because that was the only way
they could do that. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's so interesting.
And it's just,
I do not have artistry skills necessary to.
And it takes a lot of time. You have to be really patient. Mm-hmm. You got to get just to the right depth. It's a whole process. I guess, you know, those people addicted to pain or whatever, it dried out a little bit. And
yikes.
Yeah.
That's not okay. That's okay for other people. That's not okay for me.
It's not okay for
me. I'm like kind of cringy thinking about it. I mean, my tattoo didn't hurt that bad.
Yeah.
I have a watercolor. And it's so it does kind of change. It is beautiful. But it did change it. It hardly hurt at all.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Like barely, like no pain almost. Oh. I mean, but he had also was doing, instead of a super saturated, like, you know, oak black color.
Right.
He had all the color swipes. You know, that he was doing. So he was doing it like a watercolor, like literally painting over it over and over and over again.
Oh.
So instead of like a deep, like, rah, you know, it was, I think it was just more gentle than maybe other styles. I might be wrong, but it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it to myself though.
No. Well, and I mean, the issue is that people share needles.
Oh yeah, no, that's not good. Buy it on Amazon, please. Please.
Yeah. Don't break open a pen.
Oh no, no, no.
And use that ink.
No.
Because that's not made for tattoos. Okay, it's not made to be in your body.
No, not at all. So there's a kit available. It's not that bad.
Yeah.
Just please.
Or just don't. Just pay a professional.
Or just pay a professional. They're good at this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
They really are.
Don't get your friend who's, you know, tattooed a pig leg or something before. Go to an actual professional who's had training.
Yes.
Yeah. And the final thing that I have, no matter what you think about the truth of the story of Sammy Jenkins, his wife, who was Sammy's caregiver, and the struggles that she suffered are absolutely real.
Oh.
You know, just how difficult it can be. Caregiver.org has an article about how most people will either be caregivers or need one at some point in their life. And that a lot of families end up dealing with a family member with a cognitive impairment of some
sort
kind.
Of dementia.
Yeah, dementia or Alzheimer's or traumatic brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those things, they can really change how a person acts and thinks and feels. So the person that you knew is not the person that they are now. Yep. And it can be very challenging to deal with. And a lot of those people afflicted with this cognitive impairment do need care around the clock.
Yeah.
Not everybody's able to afford to have them stay in a residential facility.
Right. Yeah. Or really, and that's the part of the problem we have with our healthcare, is that a lot of people can't afford to have in-home care either.
Right.
So they're trying to make it happen, but it's really hard. You and I both have already kind of been in those positions. And and so it is hard. It's hard to say goodbye to that person who is there, especially because there's like, I don't know if you experienced this, but there seems to be like these flashes of lucidity.
Oh, yeah.
Where they come back for a minute and then you're like, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
Gone so, so fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was hard.
Yeah.
So it's just difficult.
Well, my father-in-law had Alzheimer's and it was really, I really knew that who he'd been was gone.
Yeah.
Because it used to be, he had kind of that short-term memory loss.
Yeah.
Like what Leonard's going through here. Like he couldn't remember things you just told him, but you could ask him about his childhood and he could remember that stuff.
Right. So he could tell you that.
Uh-huh. And yeah, he could tell us that. And we'd leave the kids with the sitter and, you know, the three of us would go out to eat and that's what we would talk about. And I can remember going once and asking him for a story that I knew that he enjoyed telling, and he couldn't remember that one anymore either.
Oh,
and that's so hard. Yeah, it was sad and tough. Yeah. And you know,
that's when it starts to affect their personality.
Right. Yeah.
Because they don't draw on those things to inform them anymore.
Right.
Which is an automatic process you don't think about, but once they don't, right? And they just are who they are at that moment. And that's the hard thing about
it. Well, we were so fortunate because who he was at that moment was very sweet.
And that's good.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people have opposite experiences.
Right.
Violence.
Well,
and,
because they don't. They feel angry or frustrated or upset,
scared.
And they don't know why.
They're scared.
Yeah.
Paranoia is very common.
Yeah.
Especially with Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
You know, paranoia, and then because of that, the fear, nobody, you just don't, they don't trust anybody.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and they can be angered or upset by something, and a door closes, and they don't remember what they were angry or upset about, but they still feel that way.
Right.
And they don't know why.
Right. I mean, if you've had a child, you know what that's like, except that they're not children. So the consequences of it is like, yikes.
Yeah. You can't just like hug them and put them down for a nap and it's better when they get up.
Right.
You know?
You can't do that.
No.
It's
unfortunately
that's so hard. But
the really, the thing that you most have to try and find a way to do is let the caregiver have some downtime to get so they don't have the burnout of not being able to care. Respite care is so important for particularly family members who don't have a training for caring for this type of person, but they still need to do it.
Yeah. It's, yeah. We have to support caregivers. And then, you know, when the time comes and that chapter is over, really just healing, mm-hmm. because it's a prolonged traumatic event. And so there's a lot of post-traumatic stress there, mm-hmm. right? So right. you have to heal. You have to take time to heal. And it changes kind of you when you've been a caregiver. It really does. Mm-hmm. So,
well, and we were really fortunate because my sister-in-law did a lot of the heavy lifting caregiving. Okay. We were her respite, basically.
Oh, okay. Good.
I mean, we about split time, mm-hmm. pretty evenly until he really needed to go into a residential facility for his own safety. Mm-hmm. But she handled doctor's appointments and all of those.
That's nice.
All those
that's
sort
good.
Of things.
See,
yeah.
that's what the big network is for.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
all
good.
Right. So
next time,
we're going to talk about a crime scene, the vanishing at the Cecil Hotel. We're going to watch the first episode. There's only four episodes
it's one of those
to it.
Kind of docuseries things.
Yeah, it's like a short mini sort of series on Netflix, and it's at the hotel with a really questionable past to begin with, and then they're looking into the specific case of Eliza Lamb, and that really drew out the armchair detectives because people are trying to figure out what the heck happened.
Right. I can't
wait. I can't either.
Yeah, it's gonna be great.
You know, that was one of those things that I had intended to start watching, and then, you know, I don't know. Are you going to have power for 5 minutes or 3 hours? You don't know. So, you know, that's why we're... I had planned to start watching this like a couple weeks ago.
Gotcha.
Didn't get to it. And then, you know, power things. This is why we're a month behind
a
week from stuff.
It
because
was so crazy.
You couldn't do or plan anything.
No. No, you really couldn't.
No.
I mean, it was, we a lot of places in Texas had rolling outages, which were their mm-hmm. own kind of burden. But we ended up having just outages.
Yeah.
Right? And then you get that 90-second burst where you could tell they were just trying to flip it on and see if it worked.
Uh-huh.
And then it just failed.
Oh.
Right? And it was like, I can't handle this. So anyway, we're all behind. But you know what? This will be great. I'm looking forward to getting into it.
Me too.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah. In that weird... true crime,
I know,
fun way.
We're
so
weird.
But you're weird too, which is why you listen. Uh-huh. So it's great. We're so glad you're here.
Yes.
Speaking of which, you know, make sure you rate and review and tell a friend, because it's way more fun when you listen with a friend. Until next time, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.